Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nolan. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. This is a program once a week that we take on a very serious and sometimes absolutely essential issue that is not being covered fairly or at all by the mainstream or alternative medias, and yet impacts so many people. Today, we're going to explore the pseudo-psychiatric science, drug advertising, and corruption behind America's epidemic of mental illness. Joining us in this dialogue will be Dr. Bruce Levine, a clinical psychologist in Cincinnati and an activist. And he is the author addressing the societal problems in our corporate healthcare system. He is a regular contributor to Z Magazine, Alternet, Adbusters, The Ecologist, and The Huffington Post. He is a member of the Mind Freedom International and is on the Advisory Council of the International Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology. His most recent work is Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. It is a very thorough investigation into the psychological underpinnings behind America's public passive position when it comes to the political powers and what we can do to take back our freedoms. Joining Dr. Levine will be Martha Rosenberg. Martha is an investigative health reporter, commentator, and an editorial cartoonist who has written extensively on the dangers of industrial food and pharmaceutical drugs, device practices by the big drug makers, pharma advertising, dangers of antibiotics oversight for efficiency and efficacy. She is a frequent contributor to the San Francisco Chronicle and the Providence Journal and the Chicago Tribune. Martha has recently published her first book, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Health, Public Health. That includes many interviews with physicians and researchers and insiders willing to come forward to speak about the devious practices of the drug and food industrial complexes. Nice to have you both with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's wonderful to be here.
Great to be on, Gary.
Thank you.
Hi, Martha.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Bruce.
For those of you who are just joining us for the first time, and the good news is that unlike many radio stations, Fox News has lost about 17% of its audience. Pacifica is down almost 70%. We're gaining 5,000 brand new, younger listeners every day. That adds to the millions already on board. So we're happy to have you on board. And this is a program where I will ask some in-depth questions. Then I stay quiet and allow my guest unlimited amounts of time to roll out their answers, because I believe we should use this form much like a classroom on the air, where they're not interrupted, where there's not just chit-chat, but real in-depth insight. So if you wonder why I'm not interceding, it's because they're sharing something in context with stories that highlight the significance of this information. Let us begin. First, this is for both of you. When you take a look at the enormous amount of money that's made within the antipsychotic drug industry, and also with antidepressants, now grossing more than $25 billion annually in the U.S. alone, this is not a source of revenue that will go away, no matter how many exposés you do, no matter how much litigation is lost. So we have to address, how do you inform the public when the media has betrayed it, sold itself out, and when so many people in Congress who should know better are allowing these people to get away with diagnosing for diseases that do not exist, to sell drugs that can only have some serious side effects. And simultaneously, there's also the rapid increase in mental illness. But the two are exclusive to each other. So draw the connection between the increase in prescription psychiatric drugs and the rise of mental illness in the country, and what studies support this relationship. And then from that, both of you should address what evidence and examples are there that drug treatments for mild or even, let's say, psychological conditions worsen the condition when they are medicated and leads to treatment that has very serious outcomes. Think of how many people just go through normal life crisis, anxiety, depression, and rightly so in today's society. And then ask yourself, what has happened in the past when persons have had broken relationships, got fired from jobs, downsized, had losses, looked in the mirror one day and didn't like how they saw themselves, where the kid was acting out and showing disdain or distemper towards the parents, when people looked at a society and were just overwhelmed by how much can go wrong? This is not new to us today. And just imagine what would happen if we had psychiatric diagnosis as we do today for everything, if this were the Great Depression. Would anybody be left undiagnosed and untreated? Think of what it was like growing up in the Great Depression, as our parents did or grandparents did, and compare that to growing up today. So those are the issues we're going to address initially. Let us begin with you, Martha. Show us your perspective on this. Take us through this whole dynamic.
Well, okay. First of all, I know that Dr. Levine has written a lot about the mental illness, the so-called epidemic, and I'm not that qualified to discuss the clinical stuff because I'm certainly not a clinical professional. I'm a reporter, but I believe one of the biggest, certainly you're right that now we're encouraged to define everyday life problems as mental illness. But I think the biggest proof that it's conjured up by Big Pharma and not people really having problems that they didn't used to have is how much aggressive marketing is done. And one example that came to my attention recently, a girlfriend of mine, her daughter was called to an assembly at her middle school, and they were addressed by a pharma front group told that they probably were bipolar and it wasn't just growing up, it wasn't just adolescence. And, you know, the aggressive way in which these diseases are sold to me is proof of the fact that they're made by pharma and sold to people who then go and pursue the drugs. So, but I certainly agree with you that we didn't used to be this way. I read this last, most recent New York Times Magazine had a statistic in there that really shocked me, which is that it said 1/4 of all U.S. women are on antidepressants. And so that's my initial thought. I'd like to hear what Dr. Levine has.
All right. Let's go over and ask Bruce his opinion. Bruce, take us through what you see as the overdiagnosing, the over-medicating of the American public for profit, and is there legitimacy in the diagnosis? Do they have qualified science to determine that if you're called bipolar or schizophrenic or whatever you're called, that there is science to prove that? And if not, what is the proof? If there is, what is the proof? And then if there's no science to prove that people are as crazy as we've been led to believe, has brain chemical imbalances that we've been led to believe, then what does that mean about all the treatment? If we start off, and I'm just saying this, I'll listen to your answer, but if you say we do not have all this science to back up all this diagnosing and treating of adults and seniors and children, even toddlers, then what does it mean when a doctor gives a prescription medication that has very serious side effects, including suicide as a side effect? What does it mean is about the responsibility of not only the psychiatric community, but medicine in general and science in the larger sense of allowing this to go unchallenged? The forum is yours.
Well, I think a lot of what happens to people out there who ordinarily have a much better critical analysis of what's going on is that they encounter psychiatry and the whole medication thing when they're at their most vulnerable, either for themselves and their children. So the first thing I think that people in your audience need to keep in mind, this is a giant industrial complex. We all know about the military industrial complex, and we distrust that, and the energy industrial complex. And we have one here. I think real pertinent line is one of the major critics of the military industrial complex, a guy named Chalmers Johnson, said, I guarantee you when war becomes that profitable, you're going to see a lot more of it. And the same thing with mental illness. I guarantee you when you see anything become that profitable, there's going to be a lot more to it. So really all of these things have to do with follow the money trail. When you can create blockbuster drugs through marketing and advertising, whether it was first with Prozac and then all these others that are $2 billion, $3 billion, $4 billion a year drugs, antipsychotics. I mean, the whole antipsychotic industry 25 years ago was a chump change, $250 million a year industry. But these guys decided that we're going to market, by the way, illegally market these drugs to use off-label, what that means for your audience, to use for conditions that aren't psychosis. So basically, the reason why the antipsychotic industry is the largest class of largest grossing class of drugs in America is that they've been able to market it to use for little kids who are disruptive with no psychotic symptoms, used for old people in nursing homes, basically used as a kind of a chill pill right out of 1984, right out of Brave New World. And so that's something that people need to keep in mind. Now, when we get to, once you have that much money to be made off of something, that's going to control a lot of factors. And so when we get to your whole question, the issue of the lack of science, well, we've known for a long time, we'll just take one issue. A big issue, by the way, is this whole chemical imbalance theory of depression, chemical imbalance theory of almost all of these so-called illnesses. And that's very, very important in the marketing. It's sort of like how the weapons of mass destruction, lies, got us into Iraq. That's how the chemical imbalance theory is very important to get people to use drugs, because most people are a little uncomfortable with the idea of just using drugs. I mean, you know, if you took a look 25 years ago, almost nobody would take antidepressants. It would be a big deal to take any kind of psychiatric drug. Nowadays, it's no big deal at all for people. They take them, you go to a doctor and you say, I'm a little anxious, I'm a little depressed, and they'll give you Prozac, Paxil, like nothing. They'll give it to you like aspirin. Why? People have bought into this idea like chemical imbalance. Well, here's the thing, and I've talked about this, people can go and read these articles, I'm not the only one talking about them. Actually, as early as 1998, Elliot Valenstein, a neuropsychologist in Michigan, wrote about this in a book, Blaming the Brain. We had people checked out this chemical imbalance theory. It was in terms of, let's talk about depression, the area that I'm most familiar with, because my previous book before the Get Up Stand Up was about depression. And they've checked this out, and what they did was they said let's investigate whether people really do have a serotonin imbalance, which is one of the neurotransmitters, the most famous one, because Prozac was this serotonin, this SSRI, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, supposedly was supposed to keep more of your serotonin within the neurosynapse. And what they said, and if you listen to these commercials real closely, they cover themselves always. They say, well, it may be due to a chemical imbalance, but the implication for most people out there, and even most doctors, is that they know that depression is caused by this chemical brain imbalance, this low levels of serotonin. Well, in fact, research was done as early as the 80s and the 90s that disproved this. What'd they do? Well, there was a couple of different ways they did this research. One was they took a look. You can't peer inside neurotransmitters. So what they did was they took a look at people's metabolites. So they took a look at your serotonin metabolites, your other neurotransmitter metabolites in bodily fluids, like your cerebrospinal fluid. They took a look at depressed people, not depressed people. No difference. They did another way of looking at this. What they did was they gave people certain kinds of they gave people certain kinds of things that would deplete their serotonin, and they took a look at people who were depleted. Did that give them more depression? No, it didn't. Did it worsen people's depression if they were already depressed? No. The only thing that it did when you depleted people, it affected people who were already on antidepressants. And so what we actually know from the research is that the only thing creating chemical imbalances out there that are really hurting people are these psychiatric drugs, which is either tragedy or kind of irony or dark humor, depending on the way you may call it. So there's absolute lack of science in their most fundamental marketing thing, this chemical brain imbalance thing. If they told people the truth that psychiatric drugs, all they ever do is that they take the edge off, and for some people it makes them a little crazier. For some people, it actually taking the edge off helps them out. No different than alcohol, no different than pot, no different than anything. For some people, it it helps them function. For a lot of other people, it does nothing. And for other people, it makes them even worse. That's really what all these psychotropic drugs do. And make no mistake about it, illicit drugs, alcohol, psychiatric drugs, they're all psychotropic drugs, which just means that they affect people's neurotransmitters, serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine. And we could get into the whole other issues of complete unreliability of the whole diagnostic procedures and other things if you're interested in that later.
Thank you for that. So let's take this to what I understand you to be saying, that there is no science, legitimate science, proving a brain chemical imbalance for serotonin or norepinephrine, and hence the suggestion that by giving a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRI drug, which are given by the millions, tens of millions, that that's going to correct something. A, there's no science that there is a chemical imbalance, and B, there's no science that if you give this drug, you will correct that imbalance. Is that correct or not?
That's absolutely correct. And for people who want to kind of check out all the documentation on this, the actual journals, the research, what I was just talking about, they could go to my website, brucelevine.net, go to articles, go to the last one that I put in alternate called How Psychiatry Stigmatizes Depression Sufferers, and I give hyperlinks to all of the research that I'm talking about here. So it's all documented in that.
Gary,
one second. Sure. And I'm going to come right over to you in a moment, Martha. One more follow-up question on this, Bruce. So we're looking at what percentage of the American female population are using these drugs on a regular basis. I've been told a figure, and I've examined it, but I'm not sure you would be closer to being more accurate than I would, but I was told that it's upwards of 25%. And then what does that mean about A, disempowering women, B, has an underlying misogynist view that women are simply there as disease symptoms to be manipulated and exploited, and what does that mean also for the larger psychiatric community not to have come in and done what you've done, the National Institute of Mental Health that does the funding and oversight and gives legitimacy to this whole notion of you have a disorder and therefore will support your drug therapy. What does this do to keep Americans, especially in this case women, keep them medicated? And then what do those medications do if it's not helping the woman? What are the downside effects? Could you address those, please?
Well, let me just give you the stats here. Again, if people can get this, they can see the documentation if they go, again, to the brucelevine.net, my website, and go to the article called 400% Rise in Antidepressant Pill Use. Just go to that, and you go to that article, and you'll see the hyperlinks for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's in the first line of that article. And what they talk about there, and these are going to be low because they don't talk about people giving them to their friends, you know, which happens a lot. They don't talk about them giving to them to their kids and all that. So always these percentages are probably a little bit lower than what they really are. But what they said in that article was that overall in America, what the CDC was saying, the Centers for Disease Control was saying that overall in America, 11% of us, all of us, are using of adults are using these antidepressants. What they said was that women between 40 and 59 years old, that age group, 40 to 59, they said pretty much what Martha was saying, roughly a quarter, about 23% of women are in that age group are using antidepressants. It's a significant thing. I mean, one of the things that I care about the most, there's obviously the drug company corruption, the psychopharmaceutical industrial complex, the pseudoscience of how diseases are created and how they're diagnosed. But the thing that becomes, you know, for me, a really hugely important thing is the political element of this, is that because there are, in fact, a lot of very depressed people in America. I mean, those 23% of women aged 40 to 59 years old, I think it's not much to do about nothing. I mean, it's not like these people are just a little unhappy and that's why they're going to go and pop some pills and they just need to toughen up. No, the reality is you got some very miserable people in the United States of America. And so what's happened here, and this is the whole psychopharmaceutical industrial complex, in addition to harming people physically and ripping them off financially, They've helped depoliticize people. In other words, the propaganda and the marketing is to have people convinced that their depression, their anxiety is all about some kind of mumbo jumbo biochemical brain imbalance, and not take a look at what's going on in their society and in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we know, for example, let me just give you a quick example on this, and then let Martha talk, but we know, for example, there's no correlation at all to any kind of chemical brain imbalance. You go to a doctor, they do not diagnose depression with any kind of lab test, EEG, blood test. But where is there an association? Well, for your audience, this is going to sound like common sense, and it will be to them. Everybody but psychiatrists, it will be common sense. There's a high association, a high correlation between depression and unemployment, between being on public assistance, between being in debt. In debt, there's a huge correlation if you're in debt. So if you have financial pain, you're going to be more likely to be depressed. If you're socially isolated, you're going to be more likely to be depressed. And so we have a culture that doesn't care about people having community and connectedness, and so you have more isolated people. We have people who, if you are in a miserable marriage, and lots of times these marriages become misery by economic conditions, you're much more likely to be depressed. And so pain, overwhelming emotional pain, is a huge source of depression. And when you get people not to understand that, you get people to stop looking at the nature of their culture, the nature of their society, that doesn't give a damn about average human beings, that only cares about corporations making tons of money. And so that's why the psychopharmaceutical industrial complex is helping depoliticize people, and that's why people at the very top love it. Not only the media makes a ton of money off of the commercials, not only these pharmaceutical companies are making a ton of money off of these drugs, but also the people at the very top, the 0.1% who want to retain the social hierarchy, they love it because it keeps people from thinking politically about what the heck, why they're really miserable.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. Martha, before we go to you, let me just add this thought, and if you decide to answer this, fine. If not, then this will be out there for Bruce to answer when we come back to him. Should we not also step back and look at what has gone on for the last 40 years, at least in the inner cities of America, that have been, for all intents and purposes, abandoned? We've thrown money at poverty programs, but we have not tried to understand the nature of what happens when people are not given proper education, do not have the type of proper environment in which to grow spiritually, intellectually, and physically. And so then what happens when those people become depressed or anxious or angry and then sublimate? Some will sublimate with drugs and alcohol. And some people, when they're frustrated and depressed, will sublimate with food and comfort foods. Should we not also be able to look at the enormous amount of teen drinking, teen drugs, and other acting out processes and address this, is what Bruce was discussing, is when you neglect a problem and then people are at the lower end, that causes depression. And from depression, people either A, become apathetic because they feel powerless, in which case they almost always turn inward and self-destruct, or they turn outward and get even by joining a gang or by breaking out of their environment and freeing themselves. And we never discuss this. And we'd rather have a war on drugs. We'd rather have a prison industrial complex. We'd rather pathologize people. And then that disempowers them and keeps us from looking at the whole problem. Anyhow, if you feel you can address that or would like to address it, please do so. But my direct question to you, in your area of expertise, is you've investigated particular drugs which are not meant to be psychoactive and are given for non-mental conditions, for example, some asthma drugs. However, right, they are in fact psychoactive. Why then are these drugs being approved, and what have been some of the adverse effects on mental health due to these drugs?
Well, why are they approved? Because there's a lot of conflicts of interest within the regulatory agencies, and they don't even try to hide it. It's outrageous. The guidelines for the asthma drugs were written by pharma doctors, pharma consultants. So all the dangerous drugs that we talk about are approved the same way through an FDA that very much is identified with the industry. It thinks of itself as an arm of pharma. And then through, of course, a direct-to-consumer advertising. I wanted to get back for a second to Bruce's point, because I heartily agree that when you convince people that they're impaired, they're not going to rise up and get angry and say, wait a minute, this is society, this is wrong, this is injustice, this is, you know, it does depoliticize, it isolates. And you talk about the demographic of women between 40 and 59. They're very much targeted now with campaigns of don't you have migraines, don't you have fibromyalgia. And you mentioned, you know, eating too much, maybe there's a food compensation. And all this convinces people that they're sick or they need a drug rather than uniting them in an awareness that there's, you know, there's an economy that's very sick. Women have been, you know, the different issues we talk about with feminism. But one site that I always recommend to people is called askapatient.com, and it's kind of like a Yelp for drugs. And when you go onto that site, you'll see women begin to raise their consciousness, and they'll say, now that I've heard what you three or four women have said about this drug, I was told the same thing, and yet it had awful side effects with me, and what are they doing to us? And you see a conscious level raising, specifically with women who are given these almost placating drugs for diseases that they don't have. And I think it's very useful to the profiteers to convince people they're sick, as opposed to letting the people get angry and indignant and question things.
All right. Then let's extend that. There was a report recently that only about 12 to 15% of psychiatrists engage in talk or psychological therapy, meaning 85% of psychiatry today is simply diagnosis and prescribing drugs. For that reason, we can find a rationale for drug makers to continually create new analogs of psychiatric drugs and push it on the profession. But many of these drug makers are found guilty for a range of crimes related to illegally promoting certain psychiatric medications, antidepressants, and antipsychotics for unapproved uses. Moreover, many of these classes of drugs have been proven to be extremely dangerous, but are being approved and registered by the FDA nonetheless. So speak about this marriage between the drug makers and the FDA, and why federal health officials continue to permit this to continue, and in particular speak about the AstraZeneca best-selling drug, Seroquel, that has now been responsible for numerous adverse effects, including death.
Well, you want to go, Martha? Go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead with that, Bruce?
Well, you know, I think what I touched on a little bit earlier, I think the audience needs to kind of understand is just, you know, so they, we use the term off-label marketing. Mm-hmm. What happens to these drug companies is that the big thing that they get in trouble for, and I've written a lot about, for example, Eli Lilly off-label marketing Zyprexa, but they've all gotten, almost all these major drug companies, what they do is what that means off-label marketing is that they take their drug representatives and they go to these doctors and they try to get them to use these drugs for what the FDA has not approved it for. So, for example, Eli Lilly makes a drug called Zyprexa, which is an antipsychotic, which you think like, well, how much money could you, how many psychotics are walking around in America here? How many schizophrenics? Well, you know, they figured that too. So they figured like, well, we're going to go and tell these doctors, like, you know, you could use them for little kids who are not behaving all that well. You could use them for old people who are giving you a hard time. Mm-hmm. And that's illegal. That's called off-label marketing. That's mm-hmm. illegal. Now, the interesting thing, now this might upset your audience some, it's not illegal for a doctor to prescribe a drug for almost anything. So a doctor can prescribe a drug for whatever the heck they want. And that's not illegal. So that's part of the whole problem. And so, you know, when you have these drugs that have potential $3-4 billion, I'm not saying million, I'm saying with a B, $1 billion, mm-hmm. what happens to a company like Eli Lilly, and again, there I just pick on them, but there's a lot of these other ones who've gotten into even, you know, bigger trouble, is that they size it up and they go like, well, we can make $3-4 billion a year. So what? Worst possible thing happens is we're going to get fined somewhere for doing this. We're going to get in trouble and somebody's going to slap a fine, a few hundred million, maybe even a $1 billion fine on us. And that's exactly what's happened. It's just the cost of doing business. There, mm-hmm. I get calls all the time from drug company representatives. They email me, they talk to me, and they tell me, Bruce, the only way this is going to end is if these executives do jail time. time. They do jail time. This is serious stuff. People are dying because of this stuff. But executives know. It's never happened. It's never even been an issue. They've never even charges been thrown at them. Until these executives at these drug companies do jail time, this will continue.
And Martha, I could add something
Martha,
to that.
Add on to that, but Martha, a separate question for you after you address what Bruce
okay,
just addressed.
You know, Bruce has mentioned Eli Lilly and Zyprexa. In April of 2009, I attended some hearings to legalize or approve Zyprexa, Seroquel, and Geodon for children. And I was able to watch that whole dynamic of how the hearings go. But what I found really ironic, it's exactly as Bruce says, is that all three companies who went in and asked for approval to market to kids had already been accused by the Justice Department of doing just that and pled guilty and paid fines. So they were literally asking for forgiveness, not permission. They'd already done it. They were already illegally marketing to children. And during the hearings, many of the researchers and the experts questioned the side effects, you know, that these atypical antipsychotics have, which they cause diabetes and weight gain. There was one, Geodon causes a great increase in heart rate. And so these experts walked through all the negatives with these drugs, not to mention that the three companies had already illegally marketed them to kids anyway, but they approved them. Okay, why did they approve them? Because the FDA and its culture prides itself on approving, not rejecting drugs, because they don't want to look anti-pharma, anti-progress, anti-peers. And so it's almost like you can't get a drug not approved. When you look at the issues that they knew these drugs had and the idea of giving them to kids who are probably going to be on them for life. You know, so it's exactly as Bruce said, that the penalties are a joke, because they'll make in one quarter they'll make back the penalty amount. And so unless jail time, and the other thing would be withdrawing, you know, their Medicare and Medicaid privileges. But right now they're not hit at in any way in which it hurts them.
Martha, talk about your research on how Big Pharma sells depression drugs to patients who don't need them.
Well, that, you know, in my book, Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health, I talk a lot about the direct-to-consumer advertising, which I think is responsible for a lot of this, the growing numbers of people with depression. And what you begin to see happen, there's sites like WebMD, you know, that really hold up the pharmaceutical industry. They begin to redefine depression as a bad day or, as Bruce said, you know, a bad job, a bad marriage, real-life problems. And then another very insidious thing that I've seen happen that I don't believe is at all medically accurate is they're starting to call depression progressive. And it always was considered a self-limiting disease. So once pharma convinces people something is progressive and silent, it scares them into taking the drugs. You know, like they'll say you have osteoporosis, it's a silent, you know, the different diseases that get worse and you don't know it. But with the depression, then they began coming up with this idea of treatment-resistant depression, which is really a nod to the fact that the SSRIs don't work to begin with. It isn't treatment-resistant depression. It's the fact that their drugs are no better than placebos. And so that enables them to sell another drug that you're supposed to take on top of the first drug, like Abilify or something. And it's a huge racket and a hoax.
All right.
Yeah, I should add there, too, you know, one of the reasons why that these drug companies are really happy that people are taking multiple drugs, you know, they used to, like, you would think, like, well, if you sell, you know, one drug, like, you sell, like, Pfizer sells Zoloft, you'd only want them to just use your drug. Why do they want people to take extra drugs, a couple of antidepressants, maybe throw in some antipsychotics? Well, here's the reason. Because, you know, they have many lawsuits being filed against them all the time for people, you know, doing self-destructive things, suicides, homicide, many civil suits. And the thing they love is when people are on multiple psychiatric drugs, because their great defense is like, how do you know it was our drug that pushed them over the top? So that's one of the things.
It indemnifies them.
Exactly. Exactly. And the other thing that Martha was talking about these, these drugs being, that's a nice other in their marketing tactics besides the chemical imbalance. They're telling folks it's progressive. Well, people should know, and people, old time psychiatrists know this. Anybody out there, psychiatrists over 60 years old, it was commonly known that half the people who ever get depression recover in spontaneous remission. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big joke whenever you hear a study that shows after 6 months' time that 50% of people got better. I mean, the National Institute of Mental Health advertised, were so happy about one of the studies that they were telling people. People who were resistant, they 50% progressed with these different antidepressant treatments. Well, anybody who's been around knows that in 6 months' time, 50% of people get better from depression through what we call spontaneous remission. In other words, they just get better. Circumstances in their life changes. Maybe an abusive spouse leaves. Maybe they get a job. Some things happen. So that's just another gigantic lie that's going on about this idea that this thing is, it's going to be progressive and deteriorating, all this stuff.
Bruce, I'd like for you to address, and then I'd like for you to, if you want to address this, Martha, two issues that are connected, that are important. And let me just remember to let people know that you're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guests are Dr. Bruce Levine and Martha Rosenberg. We're talking about the pseudo-psychiatric sciences and drug advertising and corruption behind America's epidemic of mental illness and what we're doing to actually harm people instead of help them. Here are the sequence I think that are important we address. First and foremost, the entire foundation of psychiatry and diagnosing and treatment rests upon a Bible. It is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, number 5 of psychiatry. And they come to an agreement, not based upon any science whatsoever, a consensus that a certain number of symptoms and certain type of symptoms represent a disorder. And therefore, they'll classify it, and then they'll give it a numbering system, and therefore, it'll go into hospitals and doctor's offices and insurance companies, and they all recognize it now. This is a legitimate condition, and if a doctor diagnoses this, then that patient can be treated or the drug can be given, and the doctor will be reimbursed under Medicare, or the patient will be able to get their insurance to cover it if it's recorded as a legitimate. I'd like for you to address, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry itself real science? And if so, what exact studies have they done to prove that all of their hundreds of symptoms that they then say equal a condition are based upon anything other than pure psychiatric alchemy? Where there's nothing there, it's just quicksand. And if that's the case, then that means that all of the pharmacology that they're using to treat these so-called conditions itself must be brought into question. Would you address this, Bruce? And then after that, Martha, please the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take the DSM, which is, you're right, that is one of the, hugely important, that's their diagnostic Bible. People need to know it's published by the American Psychiatric Association, sort of like the fox guarding the hen house. By the way, people need to know the American Psychiatric Association takes millions of dollars from drug companies. So right away, we have this, it's clearly in the interest of the American Psychiatric Association and drug companies to pathologize, medicalize disease as many people as possible out there. There's more money in it, okay? The more that you can convince people that what they have is a disease, the more likely that they're going to be treated, and the more likely they're ultimately going to be taking medication for it. People have to know the history of the DSM. When it first came out, the first one in 1952, is a very small, tiny little book. DSM-2 is very small, and what the interesting thing was, though, is those first two versions, they did have a disease called, guess what? Homosexuality was a disease. That disease got in there, obviously, not to do anything to do with science. None of the diseases or disorders get in there because of science. They all get in there because of culture, because of politics, because what they can get away with. And so in 1970s, gay activists said, you know what? We do not like being called disordered because we're gay. And so what did they do? They scared the hell out of the American Psychiatric Association with political protests. And what did the American Psychiatric Association do in the 1970s? They withdrew homosexuality as a mental illness. So the DSM-3 comes out in 1980. There's no homosexuality. God love the APA, the American Psychiatric Association, but don't love them too much, because what do? They replace that with hundreds of more diagnoses. The DSM-3 actually becomes a thicker book. What do? They go after kids. They figure, well, what the heck? Those kids aren't going to go out there and get organized like gay activists did. And so they came up with all those famous diagnoses, those kiddie diagnoses that we now know today. Things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, 1980. You know, how they could discover that? Well, they just decided. Kids who just, you know, they may pay attention. Studies show these ADHD kids, they pay attention to things they're interested in. They pay attention to all kinds of stuff. These are the kind of kids 100 years ago, they would have been smart kids who just weren't academics, you know, but they didn't, you know, they would work on farms, work in a whole other places. They're very intelligent. They just weren't academics. And so what did they figure? Well, we can convince everybody, every kid out there who's not crazy about paying attention to boring school must have some disease. Then what did they do? They came up with this thing called oppositional defiant disorder. Mm-hmm. When I first talked about this thing, people thought I was being sarcastic. They thought I was joking. Now they know about it because it's being used everywhere. Oppositional defiant disorder. You know what the symptoms of that, Gary? I bet you had it. I bet all three of us had it. I bet you every artist and political activist in American history had it. It's called, here's the symptoms. Often argue with adults. You know, often refuse to comply with adults' requests or rules. This is a disease, okay? And they are drugging kids. And mostly, I got to tell you, you're more likely to be drugged. You know, Medicaid will reimburse for drugging these kids with antipsychotics for poor kids. But, you know, rich suburban kids are getting drugged with them at all. So what else did they do? They decided, you know what? Nowadays in America, everybody wants a kid who's an extrovert, who's a leader. All these parents are, you know, that's what they want. So, you know, instead of saying to a parent, hey, it's okay, you have a shy kid. Lots of shy kids have done some amazing, interesting things in American history. Sometimes they even outgrow their shyness. But, you know, shyness can be a pretty cool thing. You know, it's okay to be introverted. No, they didn't do that. They told parents, you know what? You've got social anxiety disorder. The people who make Paxil especially did this, Glaxo. They went out and hired public relations people, and they convinced people that you've got a disease. And their slogan was, you know, imagine being allergic to people. So they convinced everybody of this. And this is the power of marketing. And by the way, this document, that's only the DSM-3. DSM-4 gets bigger and bigger. They're working on the DSM-5 right now. They're coming up with even more stuff. And so the bottom line to your question is, Gary, these things are just totally invalid. They're not diseases. And even if you believe in oppositional defiant disorder, even if you believe in all these 400 diagnoses in the DSM-4, they're scientifically unreliable. What does that mean? It means if you took the same person to 10 different clinicians, you would get completely different. There's no agreement that a person even has a disorder. So since you don't use blood tests, brain scans, or anything like that, it's all about judgment. It's all about people's subjective opinions. There's no scientific reliability. And so that's the important thing. It's invalid. It's scientifically invalid because these things are not diseases. They're just the way human beings, different temperaments, different human beings. But even if you believe that oppositional defiant disorder is a disease, it cannot be reliably diagnosed, okay?
Martha, please share your insights on this.
Well, certainly I agree with everything that he said. And I do think that it's significant that the actual writers of the DSM are kept confidential for exactly that reason, because they're toadies of the pharmaceutical industry. And there have been some exposés in the past about how many of them were consultants to pharma, but they have not named them. They keep the names. That almost reminds me of firing squads, how nobody knows who has a live bullet. You know, I mean, they don't let anyone know who's actually writing it, and it is a revenue-producing document. The APA itself, the Psychiatric Association, doesn't make much of an effort to hide it, how much in bed it is with pharma. The outgoing president, Chantzberg, had just, you know, many, many consultancies and for pharma and didn't try to hide it. And when I've been to their conventions, I'm always amazed at the workshops are just commercials. And they'll say new treatment preferable to old, let's say new atypical antipsychotic is preferable to old therapies. And then it's sponsored by the pharmaceutical company who makes the drug in question. And there's not even an attempt to have a firewall between them. And I think that another very good point is that, yeah, they called homosexuality a psychiatric disease until 1981. And so it's obviously just idiosyncratic and arbitrary.
Martha, continue on. Let's talk about the enormous amount of harm done when they're treating people who suffer from trauma, especially those in war, coming back from Afghanistan or Iraq, who have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder and who are given some extraordinarily dangerous drugs. And those who do not have that are still given drugs also with a misgotten idea that it will prevent this. And then connect that with what happens to these people frequently when they come home, high suicide rates, a lot of violent acting out, inability to easily fit back into their previous roles in society, and virtually no mental health care at all. Talk about that, please.
Well, I do have a whole chapter in my book about the over-medication of the troops, and it's become very much a pharmaco-battlefield, and it's very easy, again, to see why, because some of the top Defense Department and Veteran Affairs doctors are consultants to pharma, and they don't hide it. And so they're just making money, you know. And the reason that so many drugs are now used on the battlefield is mainly because they now exist. I don't think some of these SSRIs and atypical antipsychotics were even really around during the Desert Storm, but now they're just plentiful. And so what happens is obviously the troops, when they're in the battlefield, they're given a 180-day supply, which they can overdose themselves. They can buy it and sell it and trade it. They're treated, you know, for quote-unquote insomnia in the battlefield, which really, how deeply do you want to sleep there, you know? But most of the abuse that you really hear about is when they return, the PTSD, trying to process through some of the things that they've witnessed or participated in that's very haunting. And what the military does is it dopes them up on PTSD cocktails, which include usually an atypical antipsychotic like a Seroquel, and then the SSRIs, and then some pain pills, and now what's very popular are the seizure drugs like the Lactamol and Topamax and Lyrica and Neurontin. Those are very popular, and they give these cocktails that are not tested. These drugs have not been tested with each other. Some of them, like Seroquel, interact very poorly with opiates and have caused sudden death in many, many soldiers. But one thing that is not given any awareness when these are prescribed is that the traumatic brain injuries that are so common from service over there make the blood-brain barrier more permeable, and so that whatever drug is given to someone is going to be much, much more potent. And so the TBIs, the traumatic brain injuries, make it even more dangerous to give all the drugs. And then there's the fact that young guys, they're probably going to go out and drink, you know, they might smoke some dope. So they're also maybe doing other things and not being told that's unrealistic to think that a soldier wouldn't go out and have a beer, you know. And so there's several ways in which they're being harmed. One is just physiologically, all the interactions and the side effects, which have killed many, many soldiers, according to websites I've looked at. But the other one is the psychological treatment of not letting them process their experiences. Because if you stuff them down with all these drugs to make you not aware of what's bothering you, then you're not healing from it.
Martha, are you aware that nearly as many soldiers have died from suicide since 2003 has died in the Vietnam War, and we're losing far more people committing suicide than actual battle casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan combined?
You're absolutely right, Gary. And the Army acknowledged that in 2010 in a big report. They acknowledge it, and they're in such denial that they literally do not see that as a direct relationship to the SSRIs that they're giving. In other words, why are people killing themselves? Maybe because we're giving them drugs that make them kill themselves, because those SSRIs are known for producing the suicidal ideation in that exact age group, the young adults. And so, yeah, the suicide rate has exceeded the active duty casualties, and the government sees it and does not even indict the pills that they're giving them, which, in my opinion, is the reason.
Well, I spoke with hundreds, if not thousands, of vets for the film I just released a month ago, American Veterans Betrayed and Forgotten. And without exception, every single one said that everyone they knew were taking the drugs. It changed their personality. And the stories they tell you are nothing less than bizarre. Where a completely normal person prior to taking the meds would do things that they would never have done otherwise, and then they'll end up in jail or arrested or in trouble, or no one wants to hire them. And one guy said, I was okay before I went over there. I had a very even disposition. I came back. I was on the drugs. And then I acted out against my family, my kids, my wife. I was lost my marriage, lost my home, couldn't hold a job, and ended up one day sleeping on a bench for the first time in my life and realizing something terrible had gone on, yet no one was willing to take responsibility. No one was willing to help me. And the Pentagon, the Defense Department, and the Veterans Administration have turned their backs on these GIs, and yet they've allowed the pharmaceutical company to profit by selling them expensive drugs. Bruce, your thoughts on this, and then this, Bruce, because we're running up near the end of our program. Lots of studies show now that simple placebos, sugar pills, are equal in efficacy to mild to moderate depression. Then if a sugar pill does no harm and does the same thing that a very serious side effect major drug does, why should we be still prescribing these drugs? And why is psychiatry and psychology and medicine not doing more to get them off these drugs and use other forms of non-invasive therapy to help them?
Well, just a quick thing. I want to get to that. It's been most what you're talking about right there. But on the issue of the military and psychiatry and psychology, again, for me, you can't be more unethical than what standard of care is in terms of psychiatry and my profession, psychology, in terms of basically we've changed the whole game in terms of saying it's okay to the military. Psychiatrists and psychologists have said it's okay to send people back, soldiers who need to have psychiatric medication, into combat zones. This really only started with the Iraq War. Prior to that, I mean, if somebody, you assess somebody to be in bad enough shape that they needed to be on psychiatric medication, you did not send them back into a combat zone. And why is that going on? Well, the military were looking for people again. You know, it's all about money. Martha's mentioned it several times. It's boring, but it's just true. It's like if you want to do well as a military psychiatrist, you know, let's find somebody who sanctions us, who lets us do what we want to do. And so they'll find the psychiatrists and psychologists, move them up to colonels and generals who say it's okay to put people who are on heavy psychiatric medication, which we know, by the way, the Food and Drug Administration, after years and years of work by folks, dissident mental health professionals, finally put these warning labels for young adults, teenagers, kids, and people under 24 that these antidepressants double the risk of suicide attempts. And so you've got folks on these in combat zones. It's utterly insane. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, to get to your other question here about the whole issue of these antidepressants and effectiveness, again, this is something we've known for a long time. And the person who's finally, after guys, you know, dissident mental health professionals talking about this for a decade, finally, 60 Minutes, you know, did a show. A lot of people in your audience might have saw on this guy, Irving Kirsch, that I talked about in Surviving America's Depression Epidemic as early as 2007. What did he do? Irving Kirsch was at the time at the University of Connecticut. He's moved on to Harvard. But what did he do is that the drug companies don't, they pressure people who've done these studies not to publish studies that show these antidepressants are worthless or have negative effects. And so they're just shoved away in file drawers. But what you have to do is register all trials on antidepressants with the FDA, with the Food and Drug Administration. So Irving Kirsch used the Freedom of Information Act, and he got all the studies that had been done on these Prozac, Paxlovid, about six of these antidepressants, and he took a look at them. And what he found was in the majority of these studies, the drugs did no better than a placebo. And then if you looked at them all in aggregate, the drug slightly edged out the placebo, but it was negligible, okay? It was, mm-hmm. And this is, I got to tell folks, all of these are drug company studies, and I go into details in my books and articles about how they load the dice. They use certain kind of measurements to make these drugs more effective, look more effective than they really are. But mm-hmm. even with all their dice loading, okay, mm-hmm. in these drug company studies, you know, the drugs really fail to outperform these placebos. Okay, so how come these drugs get approved? Well, this is going to really shock a lot of people in the audience, and this goes to what Martha was talking about, the whole corruption of the FDA. All you need to do is have two studies that the FDA, you know, that you could show to the FDA that you can show some statistical significance in terms of the placebos, you know, the drug being slightly better than a placebo. You could have done 100 studies, okay? Now, in real statistics, you know, if you do 100 studies and you only come up with two studies that show that it's more effective, then this drug is not more effective. But the rules of the game are absurd and crazy, mm-hmm. that all you need to do is show a couple of studies that they're effective. Well, if you did 100 studies on anything, if you did 100 studies on M&Ms, you could find them more effective than a placebo. Okay?
All right. Well, we're out of time. I want to thank both of our guests for being on today, Dr. Bruce Levine, who is the author of Get Up and Stand Up, and we're very happy that you were on and shared your points of view with us, Bruce.
Thank you, Gary.
And Martha Rosenberg from Chicago, who is the author of Born with a Junk Food Deficiency, How Flax, Quacks, and Hacks Pimp the Public Health. Thank you, Martha, for being with us today.
Well, thank you both so much. I greatly enjoyed discussing this stuff, and I hope that a lot of people really think about what is going on. So thank you so much.
And they do. This program may be downloaded as many as 200,000 times this week. It's the number one downloaded
wonderful.
Program in the United States on the radio. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. If you do want to download any program, please go to our archives. It's there 24/7 for you. Have a nice day, everyone.